I want to share some meditations this morning with you. And I'm encouraged. There is a God after all. He works in our community here. And it amazes me every time. But I shouldn't be amazed, right? Because God is amazing. We read from the parasha this morning about purity laws. And from Leviticus. And as Nick pointed out, they're a little shocking to our ears sometimes. But what I want to talk about today is purity. Now, I want to start with the temple context, because I think that's a little bit foreign to us today. So I want to talk about purity in a temple context, and then apply this to our metaphors of purity, and see if it doesn't add a new twist on our understanding, and maybe even on our experience. So I'll warn you that I'm starting off with a very abstract thought or concept, but it will become practical. So if you're more of a practical person, hang on. And I'd say that the whole meditation springs from my own experience. And I just happen to be an abstract person, so I love talking about the big picture. So what is purity, and what isn't purity in the Bible? We have these terms, pure and impure. Tahor, tameh. Or some of your translations may say ceremonially clean and ceremonially unclean. And I think those second terms are better to help us as modern people listening to differentiate between what is meant and what is not meant. Because ceremonially clean and unclean take it outside of a moral framework into a ritual one. And that's one we're less familiar with. But there was this ancient conceptual world that stands behind these terms. And they are symbolic terms. Pure, tahor, is connected to life and wholeness. Impure, tameh, is connected to death or decay, or simply non-wholeness. And as a human, everyone cycles through pure and impure statuses because we're not God. We are mortal in human bodies. And things connected to mortality, birth, and death will make you impure. And the way the temple system is set up, to come into a holy place, you need to be in a whole condition, a pure state. Now, being in a state of impurity is not a sin. I'm talking now of the original term, the ritual purity we find in the Bible. At this time of year, I'm normally teaching a course on biblical law to our Hebrew students. And Nick here is now teaching that course this year. But this is one thing I emphasize all course long. Being impure is not a sin. I say it over and over again. I give examples. And at the end of the course, I give an exam. And I have this test, this question of true and false. And it says, true and false, you have to circle if it's the statement is true or false. And I say, being impure is a sin. And every year I have students circling true. And I'm like, how? But We jump to the metaphor too quickly, maybe. But think about the original context. Childbirth, right, creates impurity. That can't be a sin if God said, "Pour vous, be fruitful and multiply." Is it a sin to be born? Is it a sin to give birth? No, these are blessings. Jesus was born, and he would have become impure in his life. So it can't be a sin. And all those dealing with slaughter sacrifices become impure And yet sacrifices are good. They're a commandment. So being impure is not a sin, but it does mean you may not enter holy space in that state. And if you should not obey the rules regarding the different impurity statuses, you would be sinning, because there's different levels of impurity. But in that case, your sin is not that you became impure, but because you didn't obey the rules about it, and not obeying is always a sin. So everyone entering the holy area needs to be in a state of purity, a state of wholeness, full of life, not death, or things that represent death. Being pure is not the same as being holy. And here again, I'm talking about this ritual holiness that we see in the temple system. There was a holy space. In order to be holy, you must first be pure. But you can be ceremonially pure and not be holy. Think of purity as more a neutrality, where holiness would be positive and impure would be negative, and they're not supposed to come in contact. So there's a symbolism of purity, wholeness, and life-giving quality. And this, in the list we read about the priests, is especially true for the priests and sacrifices. It's very important how they represent wholeness and life. So we read a list of some who would not qualify based on physical defects. And others don't qualify sometimes, but do other times. And like Nick said, this may seem harsh to us. And we're maybe understanding it out of context. And so we think, what, does God hold something against these people? Are they less spiritual or somehow not good enough? No, because this is a symbolic value. It doesn't mean that you're bad if you're born with a defect, but it means you can't represent the quality of wholeness or life-givingness. It would be like saying a short person can't represent being tall. It doesn't make a short person bad. Purity and impurity don't give you higher spiritual status at all. It's not a moral thing either. It doesn't make you more spiritual or more holy to be pure. It allows you access to the holy things. The state of purity is representative of wholeness and life. And those entering the most holy spaces reserved for God need to represent wholeness and life, just like God is wholeness and life. So again, it doesn't imply moral superiority. Only God is the one moral superior, who is also holy, because he's completely other than human. Now, with this background of symbolism and temple worship, we can use these concepts metaphorically for sin. And I think that's how my students get confused, because they haven't understood the original context of purity, and they jump straight to the spiritual or moral metaphor. You know, like when the prophets say your righteous deeds are like menstrual rags, they're making a jump. They're using a metaphor in the purity world morally. So think of this concept, that to be pure, you represent life, you represent wholeness, and perfection of state. So there's this connection between what is pure and what is whole, complete. And there's a connection between what is pure and what is life-giving. So I've been pondering along these lines of the metaphor, which take these concepts of ritual purity and apply them to moral purity. And I've been thinking about pure in heart. What does it mean to be pure in heart? How do we take steps to purify our hearts? Or how do we keep them pure? So if we're following the original concept, we would suggest a connection to wholeness and something life-giving, not just innocent and devoid of sin. There's this added nuance. So there's a pattern you can observe in the world, anyone, whether you're a believer or not believer, that broken people hurt others. And you could even say broken people want to inflict hurt on others. When you're broken, when you're hurt, what's your instinct? Hurt them back, right? That is natural. And then sometimes we don't even want to consciously hurt them, but because we've been broken, we end up hurting other people. So it would follow that whole people don't want to hurt others, or maybe they hurt others less. And maybe, it's a bit of a logical stretch, but I think there's something true here. We can also reverse the order by practicing intentionally not hurting others. We become more whole. And becoming more whole makes us not want to hurt others more. It's a bit of a feedback loop. And I think this principle is true for new believers as well as for very seasoned ones. To me, maturity is like an onion. There's always more layers. The same principle taken to deeper or more nuanced level. And it makes you cry. Onion, right? So you're thinking, whoa, what are you talking about? Like, can you root this in the scripture? Yes, I want to ponder that right now. Especially two proverbs. So the first one is Proverbs 15:26. Proverbs can be hard to understand, right? Proverbs 15:26 says, To'avat Adonai machshevot ra, utehorim imre noam. The Lord abhors the plans of the wicked, but pleasant words are pure. Okay, this is interesting. Or you could translate, an abomination of the Lord are the thoughts and plans of the bad or evil person, but pure are the words of pleasantness. Okay, so it's a little hard to understand. I mean, Proverbs you have to chew on, right? But what I see here, there's a contrast between an abomination, which is highly impure, to pure. And there's also a contrast between internal words or thoughts, our intentions, and external words, which are our speech. So we have the intentions of the wicked people that are an abomination to the Lord, and that means the Lord really doesn't like it. And what are those intentions of wicked people? To hurt others, directly or indirectly. And then this is contrasted with words of pleasantness. The words of pleasantness are pure. Words of pleasantness, kindness, encouragement. And these words are spoken, not thought. These are pure. So in contrast to the secret evil intentions towards others, words spoken for someone's good are pure. They're life-giving. And I think they are life-giving not just to the one who hears them, but to the one who gives them. That's my epiphany. And I don't know if I can explain what I see so clearly in the abstract. But there is a connection between being pure and being whole and complete. There's something purifying about becoming whole. And I think we can experience this wholeness when we say true things that are good and uplifting. So here's the second proverb we can meditate on. It's Proverbs 22, verse 11. Ohev tehor lev, Hen svatav, re'ehu melech. Very cryptic statement. A lover of a pure heart, graciousness of his lips. His friend is a king. Or you can translate, the one who loves a pure heart and whose speech is gracious, the king will be his friend. So here again, I'm seeing a connection between gracious words and a pure heart. The heart is where choices and intentions are made. A pure heart generates good intentions and expresses life-giving words. Here, I think it's important to say that truly gracious words must be true. They can't be fake flattery. They have to be real. And it's not so easy to say gracious words, at least for some of us. We have in our family what we call a family meeting, where we try to sit down and both review our plans as a family, but also, you know, talk about issues we may have and try to find solutions. Anyway, the rule of a family meeting is that you start out with compliments. Each person has to give a compliment to all the other people. And you could say something from the last week that was positive, or thank someone for something, big or small. But you can't just say something generic like, thank you for being you. You know, it's got to be something specific. And you would not believe how hard this is for us. I mean, here we are, we're family. For crying out loud, we all love each other. And it's just so hard. And when we sit down to talk, the first thing we want to say is, why do you keep doing that? Why can't you just put the shoes on the shoe rack? I've said it so many times. Or you're not doing this, or... And sometimes we even start out trying to give the compliment, but immediately add, oh, you've done this nice, but I wish you would blah, 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 blah. And we immediately go into the negative. And that, of course, completely erases the compliment, which led to our inside joke as a family of take two. You know, in movies, when you do a bad scene, take two, you do it again. So if someone tries to give a compliment and it goes into a non-compliment, take two, take three, take four. I was asking the boys this morning what our record has been, and no one really remembers. I remember take eight, but some boys were saying 13 and 14. God only knows. But it's hard. And I think to myself, why is this so hard to give a compliment? And in our family, we're even tempted to skip the compliments because it takes too long. But I think because it's so hard for us, that's why we need to do it. Again, we live in a broken world. Broken people hurting each other. And accepting God's salvation through Jesus doesn't automatically fix our brokenness on this side of eternity. Someday we'll be completely whole and completely pure. But how do we let God start fixing our brokenness now? Obviously, we need his help, right? So David has this famous prayer in Psalm 51, verse 12. Lev tahor brali Elohim, veruach nachon hadesh bekirbi. Create for me a pure heart, O God. Renew a resolute or a willing spirit within me. This is the work of the Holy Spirit when we open ourselves up to him and ask for his work to purify us. But just because it's God's work in us doesn't mean we don't have to work. It's God's work in us which may also result in our work. And I like to picture a parent holding a toddler who's trying to walk. The parent's hands make it possible for the child to walk in the first place, but the child has to try to take a step. So what are the steps we can take toward a pure heart? How can we experience more wholeness? And sometimes you could say we have moments where we feel our hearts have been made whole again through confession. I would say that's definitely true. Saying true words about ourselves that are negative against the backdrop of God's love and forgiveness. But I think there's also a purifying power in speaking positive truth. So I'm suggesting that maybe by choosing to see another person's good traits and speaking them out to that person, we also receive wholeness. Especially someone who has hurt you, or maybe someone you disagree with. And again, I'm not saying here to pretend someone has not wronged you who has. I'm talking about simply looking at them with God's eyes, intentionally finding good in them to celebrate. And I'm thinking especially among believers, among those who are close to us, family, coworkers, maybe neighbors, those who are in close enough relationship to us that they can generate conflict with us. And to quote my mom, she's always saying, "We all need encouragement." It's true. It's really true, no matter who we are. Giving true words of pleasantness is pure. And I would say purifying. We may feel more whole, more full of life, when we see others like God sees them. We move closer to Him. So do we want a pure heart? Let's try giving someone a sincere, truthful, and positive word. It may take us time. We have to think about it. It might be hard for us. But I think it will not only build them up, but it will build you up, me up. We will feel whole when we do it. And I think we will see God. 1 John 4:12 says, "No one has seen God at any time. If we love one another, God resides in us, and His love is perfected in us." Notice the word perfected, whole. It's made whole, complete. And when that happens, I think we'll feel it. We may even have spiritual breakthroughs in our life as a result. We want to see God, right? So Matthew 5:8 tells us, "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God." That's my prayer for us this morning.